Before that, let me just say a few words about this sentence here. I've been, in fact, doing things completely different from particle physics over the last 3 or 4 years. And while preparing this conference, I felt like coming back home after a long travel, or you may say a long illness. It could also be appropriate. And I will try to convey to you the idea that struck me that so many things have happened in this year. So there is really a change in some areas, most of which have been covered here. So I will first of all speak about Philippe Meyer, but then I will try to give you a few flashes about things that struck me while coming back to particle physics. Okay, is this also to move? No. Okay, anyway. So, Phil Meyer was active at the beginning of the standard theory. I will say a few words about that, but then I will speak about these things, the Higgs boson, Higgs boson and supersymmetry, neutrinos, normal and less normal, and a few concepts about flavor-changing neutral processes. This is a few pictures that I got, in fact, from Nicole and from John Eliopoulos of Phil Meyer, and they make a good idea of the atmosphere that we all felt in Ecole Normale when Philippe was directing it. Very relaxed, but at the same time, a very high scientific level. Now, I went through the papers that Philippe made. It's very instructive. And so particle physics in the late 50s, that's where he started. And what was he doing? Well, he was doing the right things. He was worrying about the right things. This is the first paper about particle physics. Before, he was doing some nuclear physics. And it is about mu e gamma decay. In the intermediate vector boson theory, you would expect, with only one neutrino, you would expect muons and electrons to communicate via this. It's very strange that they took to attribute zero magnetic moment to the W, but that's a particular, which is not so important. The important point is that they found the rate for this, which was totally inconsistent with the level of mu e gamma. At that time, the Brinci ratio was had to be less than 10 to the minus 6, and that was totally inconsistent with this. And it is interesting that the same problem was addressed in these years by Schwinger in the States and by Cabibbo and Gatto in Rome, and they went all to the same conclusion. There cannot be only one neutrino. And that's the first prediction of the second neutrino that was done around the end of the 50s. And as you know, the second neutrino was discovered in Brookhaven in 1962. What is interesting is that today, the limit on mu e gamma is improved by 6 orders of magnitude. And still, we do not understand why it is so small. This is gives me the occasion to show a figure that Altarelli gave. 10 to the minus 12 is the present Brinci ratio. You don't see the line here, but it is here. These are points of different theories, and you see that all the theories would much prefer larger Brinci ratios. And instead, we know that it is less than 10 to the minus 12. So this is a crucial measurement that I hope will go on, and I will come back on that at the end of my talk. Then we go into the 60s. What was Philippe Meyer doing? Well, doing weak decays, phenomenological study of weak interaction. It was the time of Khabibov theory. And I did not know about this little paper by Bouchard and Meyer, in which they claim that first-order violation of SU3 invariance in vector amplitudes of leptonic decays are zero. That's known as the Gatto de Mollo theorem, but they discovered it at the same time. They quote Gatto de Mollo in their abstract. They discovered it after writing the paper. High energy neutrino reactions and current algebra. And this was the 60s. And as you see from these examples, following the example of Maurice Lévy, Philippe was introducing new generation of theorists to really the frontier of particle physics. What is also amusing for me is that this is what Raoul Gatto did for us. And in fact, French and Italian schools were working side by side on the same issues. They were really in parallel and following the same line of thought that finally led to the standard theory. And I like to quote this, which is a very important paper to which Philippe also contributed. The anomaly-free version of Weinberg's model is the discovery that you may cancel anomalies in the renormalizable theory between quarks and leptons. I received a letter by John Eliopoulos after the paper, which I couldn't find anymore. I lost it. But the paper concluded with a very clear sentence. There must be charm. Quarks have color and are fractionally charged. I think this paper put the end to the debate whether there were integrally charged quarks, whether color was a Lapatis alarm, etc. All that finished, and the standard theory was established in a way, theoretically. John came to Paris after being in the United States, where we worked together for some time. And with John in Paris, Rome and Paris established very close relations. That happened when the group of Phil Meyer was still in Orsay. And with Guido Altarelli, we saw the transition. We were living, in fact, in this building, which you see here at the time. Kitellis was also with us when the group moved from Orsay to École Normale Supérieure, the other side of the road. In 1974, also, the discovery of the Japes eye came. And of course, you all know that there were a lot of questions about that. And we discussed that with Tini Veltman and Gerhard. And we offered to go to Utrecht to make a discussion with them. And that was the beginning of the so-called triangular meeting. We liked that meeting, and then we repeated in different places. Then later on, other groups started. But this was the beginning of that. I still remember this workshop, which was very interesting. Also, there was a terrible rain. I never saw something like that, but that's another story. Later, other people from Rome joined. Giorgio Parisi came in. Nicola Khabibov spent a year in Paris during my sabbatical, which followed Guido's sabbatical. And a remark that was made at the time is that Roma people saw CERN flying over it going to Paris. That was the sentence. It was true, because at that time, CERN theory was totally devoted to strong interactions. And Rome and Paris were essentially the only groups doing weak interaction at the time. I don't know if you agree with that, but this is the situation. And we happily lived here under the eye of Claude Bouchard, who was the not in my pocket. Of Claude Bouchard, and of course the quiet and firm protection of Phil Meyer. So this is closes my recollection of these years. Of course, I could speak more and more. I have many other things to say, but I think that's enough. So, what about the Higgs boson? This is a slide that John Ellis showed That's the other one. It's not the same. It's not the same one. I agree with that. What a year, 2011. This is the situation in August, 26 inverse phantom barn, that by the end of the year, we know it got much better. The search for the Higgs boson took a very important turn. This is the theoretical background. That's a stability region that was mentioned also by Chris Quigg. There is a vacuum stability, a lower bound, and an upper bound is a requirement that the theory doesn't become strong too early, but in any case, before a certain energy, and this is a function of energy. At the time when we calculated that, the mass of the top was not known. Now the mass of the top is known, and this is the thing which is there. And just to introduce the thing, the discussion, this is 160 GeV, and this is 120 GeV. And you see that these are very close to the vacuum stability limit. This is the picture that Chris showed. That seems to say that if you are 120 or 25, you are in the metastable situation. But the previous curve showed that you are not yet there. So I think we could discuss that. But anyway, I don't think it makes lot of a difference. This is the situation that was after LEP. Now, I could not resist showing this wonderful picture showed by, again, by Chris, that shows the cross-section for WW production at E plus E minus. This is the one-vector boson theory. And this is the gauge theory. And this flattening of the curve in agreement with the unitarity limit is an effect of the gauge theory. It's not an effect of the Higgs boson. The Higgs boson comes at a more subtle level here. Its effect is proportional to the mass of the electron, so you would not see it. But that was essentially the level of precision by which we could know that after LEP, that the gauge symmetry, that there is a gauge symmetry in this reaction, and that this is described by Young-Mills theory. And this is the well-known blue plot, which was the conclusion of LEP, with a limit at about 115, and with a chi-square, which is obtained from the fit to the electroweak quantities, and which clearly prefers a low region. Now, the big progress happened last year. That's the result of the CMS data presented at the end of 2011 in a seminar of December with some activity here. And this is the ZZ channel, where also you can see something above the background in various positions. So, sort of. This is the expected signal for 120 GeV Higgs multiplied by 5. So you can see that this is just the beginning. How was it? The beginning of the end of the beginning, sort of. This is the ATLAS data, which show in the same point perhaps larger fluctuation. These are again ATLAS with ZZ. And this is more quantitative analysis. ATLAS, which shows an effect combining all data over sort of five inverse Phantobarn effect. This is CMS. I try to have 125 more or less at the same level. And so this is it. That's where we are now, with some evidence, perhaps, and some indication that with increasing luminosity, we may get at a better point. This is a larger view with combined experiment. What is impressive is this one, which is the new version of the blue plot. There's essentially nothing is left except this this little band in which, due to this activity that I showed you, you cannot seen in this way. You cannot exclude that there is a Higgs boson here because of this activity, which is shown here by the fact that this goes above the expected two standard deviations. We will see. I hope that in a year from now, we will be able to say something more positive. Meanwhile, I want to make a couple of remarks about supersymmetry, because this is, of course, a subject of discussion. Where is supersymmetry? And there have been attempts to fit supersymmetry with using the most simplified models. I think one should go the other way around. One should start by relying on the more firm things, more firm facts. One of these facts is that there must be two Higgs doublets, one coupled to the up quark and the other to the down quarks, sharing the vacuum expectation value. Now, in supersymmetry, the quartic coupling derives from the so-called Fayet-Eliopoulos term. I'm here recalling things that I knew very well 10 years ago and have some difficulty in getting back. More than 10 years ago, one would say that the lightest Higgs boson, which would behave more or less like the standard model boson, has to verify a very strict inequality, which is certainly not satisfied. This would bring inside the forbidden region. But fortunately, radiative corrections have been computed, and you get a modified formula where this delta here is particularly large because of the top quark mass, and it has a log which is related to the scale of supersymmetry. So if you make some approximation, you end up, substantially you say that MA is large, you end up with something like that. So this is given by this the old thing plus a correction. Sine square beta simplifies, and if you work out that, you conclude that, well, under 25 is possible. You can get, but not much more. So it's very interesting that the number that maybe is the one is compatible with supersymmetry, with simple supersymmetry, with the most simple ideas about supersymmetry. Perhaps with a scalar top a little bit high, but that's, again, is compatible with all the estimates, because all the estimates say that supersymmetry should set in at a few TeV now. Whether few TeV is 1 TeV or 8 TeV is very difficult to say. So I would say that this is very encouraging. When tangent beta, the previous angle, is large, the light Higgs of the doublet behaves like the standard model Higgs, but of course there must be also the others. And I think that if the under 25 is true, then there is all possibility that within the range of LHC, with increasing luminosity, luminosity of the order of more than 10 inverse Phantom bar, let's say 20 or 30, one can fish for these other neutral Higgs bosons. As I was saying, the SUSY parameters have been analyzed. There are a number of papers that came out. All these papers start by saying, let's suppose that under 25 is the Higgs boson. The first one I spotted is this Barger and collaborator. I'm very sorry, but we will see. I think this is a subject that will come back many times in the next year. The other subject I wanted to talk is neutrinos. The normal but exciting physics was reviewed by Guido Altarelli. That is very, to me, very surprising. I left this business when theta 1-3 was still a dream. Now, hands on theta 1-3, hints of sterile neutrinos, experimental progress in the search for two beta-beta neutrinoless decay, and a progress, very interesting, on the theory of masses. I think these are subject in movement and very, very interesting. This is a series of pictures of the places where neutrino business have been taking place. This is evidence that Guido presented from various fits for a theta 1-3, which is small but not so small, around something like 0.02, 0.03, which gives hopes that perhaps we may get a hold of CP violation in neutrinos, which is, of course, necessitates all the three angles. There have been discussions about the possibility that this effect signals a mixing with a sterile neutrino of the electron neutrino. I don't know, you can judge yourself what it is. This is certainly something to be followed. And then this is an interesting picture that shows that if you get to double beta decay at this level of mass, which is going to be difficult but not impossible, you may decide between direct hierarchy and inverted spectrum. What the oscillation give us is delta m square, but you don't know whether this is because one is very small and the other, and delta m square is m square, or whether it's just a real difference. So you have two possibilities, and double beta decay should discriminate between these two. Well, this is an interesting list that Guido made about different models. Anarchy is the most interesting, perhaps, down to the use of discrete symmetries. What I find very surprising is that one can draw a picture like that, which contains in the same picture theta 1-3 and the Kabibbo angle, maybe lambda or maybe lambda square, etc. All that is a very amusing business. I don't know where it's going to lead, but it's certainly very interesting. Now, the less normal neutrinos are, of course, the seminar also at CERN announcing the fact that OPERA has seen a velocity anomaly in the neutrinos from CERN to Gran Sasso. And this is the number that was announced, a very big one, 2.5 10 to the minus 5. It's not so different from a previous result, which was announced by Minos, which, however, is two standard deviations. This is much, much larger. There is a constraint on this quantity, however, at a very different energy, because the supernova signal of 1987, the optical signal came about 4 hours after neutrino detection. It is expected that the electromagnetic burst starts later, but only 4 hours. And if the velocity would have been like that, it would have arrived 1 year later. So that gives a very stringent limit, delta C less than 10 to the minus 9. Of course, the energies are very different, so, well, you can say whatever it is. Now, I just want to give you a feeling of how this result is arrived and what there has been a further development, which also is important to notice. What you do is you take from the detectors which are here, in fact, from the current that goes here, that's the entrance to the target. So protons arrive this way, here. They go into the target, produce the pions, et cetera, et cetera. But when they arrive to the target, they have a profile like that. This is the current. And this is about 10,000 nanoseconds wide. Now, what they did is a statistical analysis. These are the experimental points of the shape of the proton bunch, analyzing. These are the arrival times of the neutrinos, and this is the profile of the proton bunch. And they analyze that with a formal delay, with some delay that was given in a blind analysis. And as you see, these two curves don't agree with each other. And to make them agree, you have to add to delta t 1,000 nanoseconds. So at this point, they agree. The raising, you will see that the raising is very, very fast. And then you fit that. Then at this point, you open the box. You count all the possible sources of delay. And you arrive to the conclusion that that delay was about 1,000. And if you make this difference, you get the 60 nanoseconds that was announced. So as you can see, these nanoseconds come from fitting the whole bunch, the whole shape of the current. Now, there has been a lot of criticism about that by saying that the time distribution of the starting time of the neutrino, which follows, of course, the collision and then follows the decay path, may be different from the original current profile of the protons. And 60 nanoseconds is just a very small number with respect to the shape of the thing. So I think these were right objection. But what is surprising, even more so, this is a profile compute fitted with delta t equals zero. And this is fitted with 60 nanoseconds. I must say, I never saw a lot of a difference between these two. So well, of course, this is better. This is better, particularly here, but I didn't see that. So that's it. However, just before Christmas, the shutdown, they made a second run with 2 nanosecond bunches. And I think that this is what you would expect. At this point, you are free from the previous criticism. And in this case, with 2 nanosecond bunches, you can associate the event that you see with a particular bunch. You, you, you can say this is, comes from that particular bunch. And more or less, the effect is still there. So either there is an error in the previous thing, in all the chain that leads you to the calculation of what is the real time that makes between CERN and Gran Sasso, or this effect is there? I don't know. This is it. I mean, and I think we need to wait for confirmation. In the meanwhile, what about theory? Now, there was a paper long ago by Shelley, Glashow, and Coleman, which was a very simple analysis, but very clever, that says that, well, first of all, let's assume there is a special frame of reference, which is the cosmic microwave background. OK, this is it. And then you say that the Lagrangian in this frame has Lorentz non-invariant terms. For instance, you can have a different coefficient in the Dirac equation from the space and time. And of course, this gives a different velocity from the velocity of light to a mass of the neutrino. And of course, you can get a superluminal velocity. Delta C must be flavor symmetric, OK, not to spoil the observed oscillations, which would be spoiled if there were a matrix here, because we have seen in the oscillation this dependence. And all the situation is like being in a medium with a refractive index greater than 1. So the velocity of light would be less than C, and the particles can move faster than light in a medium. But what happens in a medium when, if a charged particle goes faster than the light in the medium, loses energy by Cherenkov radiation. And there is a nice paper by Cohen and Glashow and another one by Nusinov, also very clever, in which they show that by imposing conservation of energy and momentum, a neutrino like that would lose energy by emission of a plus minus pair, by neutral current. And this has always been something that Shelley has loved. I still remember when we talk about neutral currents, they say, but what happens if there is an infrared divergence due to emission of a plus minus pair? Well, this is what happens there. And this has been totally excluded by Icarus. So we know that this cannot be. So either Opera is wrong, or this idea of working in a special frame of reference is not acceptable. I'm not going to go very far, but I want to mention another line of thought, which was also devised a few years ago by these guys, by Smalley and collaborators, and by Emilino Camellia, who is in Rome now, in which they introduce a deformation of the Lorentz transformations under the hypothesis that they act non-linearly momentum space. And all this boils down to modify dispersion relations. Now here, the words is that you can write arbitrary forms for this dispersion relation. These are just two examples. And the second one does not violate CPT invariant like the first one, and introduces allow superluminal velocity, and it has a denominator with the mass of the particle, which of course for the neutrino makes this effect very large. And in fact, m with the mass of the neutrino and lambda with the Planck mass more or less would make for the effect. Take that as a yes, okay. I'm all through. So I'm concluding on that. If Opera is confirmed, the option two, that is the Coleman Glashow idea, is excluded by Icarus. Option three fares a little well, but if you apply to the protons of cosmic rays, you are done. So we don't know. We don't know what's happening. And certainly a repetition of the experiment is absolutely necessary. I will say just a few words about this subject. Flavor-changing neutral processes, which has also been mentioned by Chris, in connection with B into mu plus mu minus. For the standard model, this is very short, very low process. Branching ratio 10 to the minus 9. It should be a good indication of new physics, for instance, a minimal supersymmetric model. And at the moment, LHCb has a limit of 10 to the minus 8. And so we would expect to see something. If there are flavor carrying particles at high energy. This is a subject which has been analyzed by several people. I'm here stealing a transparency of Gino Isidori. Take, for instance, DD bar mixing. There is a small contribution, which is very well fitted by the standard model. It's, in fact, dominated by the top quark. And what happens? What can you tolerate as an addition to that? Well, it's a very impressive table. They analyzed all possible operators. You have two possibilities. You put this coefficient equal to 1, and then you get bounds of the order of 10 to the 3, 10 to the 4 TeV. Or you say, let's say the lambda is 1 TeV, what is the value of this coefficient? You get numbers which are 10 to the minus 7, 10 to the minus 9, et cetera, et cetera. And they are even smaller than, for instance, the coefficient which weights the delta mk or epsilon k. The epsilon k, the CP violation in kaons with the top quark contribution, which is the dominant one, has a coefficient, has a CKM coefficient, which is of the order of 10 to the minus 6, 10 to the minus 7. So these are really small. And I think this poses a problem. So you see, you are not the only one that is telling me to finish. These are, and of course, people are now looking very carefully if in the CKM fit with all the electroweak things, weak interaction, there is some tension. I don't have time to discuss this figure, but certainly this is a subject which will be interesting in the following year. So concluding, I have, I'm very sorry, I start getting worried. I steal the title from Chris, Particle Physics in Transition. It seems to me that we have now many hints of new vistas and new mysteries, particularly in the subject considered at the conference. The confirmation of a Higgs boson at under 25, apart from its interest, will make us to revise the plans for future accelerators. I think this is the real input that we have to have in order to understand where to go. In my mind, supersymmetry is still alive. It's only the simplest approaches that are in trouble. There was no reason why they should not. Anyway, where is it? Finally, neutrinos may change our life. And flavors at high energy are still a mystery. And that's very surprising after so many years of the standard model. So my conclusion is long life to Institut Philippe Bayer and have a nice trip back home. Thank you very much.